You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver. Gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're not in charge.
Okay.
You appear to be in charge. Do you know what the rules are here on the sidewalk?
Yes.
Okay. People aren't allowed to stand in one location. You can demonstrate all you want. You're just not allowed to stand in one location.
Okay.
So you can pass that on to your folks.
All right. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Are people, you guys... want to get arrested?
Is that... Well, I don't think anybody wants to.
Okay.
That may be a consequence. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
See how it goes.
Most of us are not risking arrest.
Okay.
Sisters and brothers, this is our community statement as to why we are here at the White House today. Several days ago, George Bush stated, "Next year will be a war year." And the quote from Aeschylus, "Truth is the first casualty of war." The truth is that war is mass killing. The truth is that God does not want us to be murderers. It is a lie to say that war and murder are the right response to terrorism. You deserve the truth about the war in Afghanistan. We are told that this is an antiseptic and humanitarian war. This is a lie. Professor Mark Herrett of the University of New Hampshire estimates that more than 3,500 Afghani civilians have died as a result of U.S. bombing since October 7th. While the Pentagon has suppressed reports of American war deaths, a journalist with a London-based Institute for War and Peace reporting discovered that Americans are dying in Afghanistan. He found that from November 25th to December 2nd, at the Khanabad Air Base used by U.S. forces, an Uzbeki working with American medical staff said he witnessed the arrival of 4 to 5 U.S. helicopters carrying between them 10 to 15 American casualties each day. End quote. Cluster bombs and so-called daisy cutters, fuel air explosive bombs used by the United States, kill indiscriminately. We are told that bombing Afghanistan is a just response to the tragedy of 9/11. This is a lie. This war is about control of Central Asia's vast oil resources. Evidence is mounting that the groundwork for military action against Afghanistan was laid as early as 1996. On September 11th, there were already huge concentrations of U.S. troops in the Middle East and South Asia. Both Pakistani and U.S. officials were warned that hostilities would break out in mid-October. All this led international law expert Francis Boyle to the conclusion that 9/11 was a pretext. We are told that this war will end terrorism. This is a lie. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld now named 6 countries where military action is imminent: Iraq, Somalia, the Philippines, Yemen, Indonesia, and Bosnia. And defense officials say that Al-Qaeda operates in 45 to 60 countries. War is breaking out between rival nuclear powers India and Pakistan and between Israel and Palestine. The war will continue. We are also told that support for the war is near unanimous. This is a lie. Even people robbed of their loved ones on September 11th are speaking out against vengeance and violence. Amber Amundson, widow of Craig, who was killed at the Pentagon on September 11th, wrote in a letter to President Bush, and read that letter right here in front of this very White House, an excerpt including stated, quote, "I do not want anyone to use my husband's death to perpetuate violence," end quote. We are also told that the military makes us safe. This is the biggest lie of all. True safety and security do not come from the barrel of a gun or the belly of a B-2 bomber, but grow from a strong and dynamic civil society, from homes, schools, jobs, health, and law. 1 billion people starve in a dysfunctional global economy where military violence enforces structural violence. As long as people throughout the world suffer, starve, and die, we in the United States will never be safe and secure. We reject the lies. We are a community of faith in Washington to commemorate the feast of the slaughter of the holy innocents. We remember the slaughter of the innocents by King Herod in biblical times. And we oppose the slaughter of the innocents in our own time, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in America, and throughout the world. We welcome you to join us. George Bush declares 2002 to be the, quote, war year. Together we can make 2002 the year of forgiveness and peace. This is our hope and this is our prayer.
Those were the voices of peace activists in front of the White House on the eve of the new year. They'd gathered in Washington, D.C. to attend the Atlantic Life Community Retreat, a faith-based gathering of peacemakers whose members have been repeatedly jailed for taking literally the biblical admonition to beat swords into plowshares. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In our first hour, we'll hear from two Plowshares activists, Susan Crane and Phil Berrigan, who were recently released from federal prison after serving sentences for destruction of U.S. military weapons at an airbase in Maryland in 1999, along with two others from the Plowshares movement. In the second hour of our program, we'll explore the collapse of the mighty Enron energy empire with Smithy in part 8 of our ongoing series, The Wizards of Money.
And into plowshares turn their swords, nations shall learn war no more.
And into plowshares turn their swords, nations shall learn war no more.
Both Susan Crane and Phil Berrigan have served repeated prison sentences for destruction of armaments. In a statement issued to explain their December 19, 1999 acts of destruction aimed against two depleted uranium-carrying A-10 Warthog aircraft, they said, "The U.S. has made another fatal mistake with depleted uranium. It has given it away to a score of other countries, openly inviting them to make their own weapons, fight their own nuclear wars, and infest the planet with more radiation." December 19th ends Advent, a time of reparation and conversion. We mark this day by mourning the civilians killed in America's wars, 9 civilians to every soldier, and by converting one hellish instrument of their death. They die forgotten and alone, no grateful nation to sorrow their passing, no flags or official ritual. They are expendable. They are the true cannon fodder. We come to the Maryland Warfield Air National Guard base to convert the A-10 as Roman Catholic Christians in obedience to God's prohibition against killing. Also, to embody Isaiah's vision of a disarmed world where hearts are converted to compassion and justice, and the weapons are converted to the tools of peace. Finally, to atone for another nuclear war in Iraq and a third in Yugoslavia. So help us, God. First, we'll hear from Susan Crane, a 55-year-old former high school teacher and mother of 2 sons. She's a resident of Jonah House, a nonviolent resistance community in Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, I wanted to start by thanking everyone for your support, for coming to the trial, for the workshops that happened in Baltimore during the trial, for the visits in the county jails and the prisons, for letters, for articles, for generous commissary support, for prayers. All this support meant a lot. You know, it seems like the Prince of Peace Plowshares and the DU Plowshares came out of communities of support, and the actions were made possible by years of preparation, by many who before us and by people around us. And I just come with tremendous gratitude for all of you and all the work that you've been doing while the time that we were inside. An important part of the resistance is the time that we travel and journey inside the prisons, because we're with the most marginalized people of our society. And it's one of the few times when we're really equal in a way, or it's the times when we really journey with these people on an equal basis. After I was in the Maryland State Prison, I went out to California, and I was in the prison in Dublin, California, FCI Dublin. And it's the same prison that I've been there before. I've been there three times now. And many of the women and the staff know me there. And when I came back this last time, they asked me why I was there. So I had a chance to talk about the Plowshares action. I called it a peace demonstration because that's a lot more accessible to people. And I talked about nonviolence, faith, and economics, usually. I talked about how there's better ways to solve problems than through violence. Violence doesn't really solve problems anyway. It just creates more violence. I talked about faith, how my faith teaches me that we're supposed to love our enemies, that Jesus gave us a new commandment to love each other as brothers and sisters. And I talked about economics, and I found all the women could understand economics for sure. The inner cities are falling apart. Their children are going to schools that don't have good boilers. The schools are falling apart. And also, we in the United States are about 6% of the world's population, and we use about 25% of the world's resources or 40% of the world's resources, depending on whose statistics you listen to. That's theft, and that can only happen because we're holding the rest of the world hostage with weapons. The prison where I was at was on an active army base. So that meant that in the morning we heard reveille. At night we heard taps. You could hear munitions exploding. You could see helicopters overhead on training missions or whatever they were doing. There were about 1,000 women there, and we were held in cells that were originally built for one person. We were held three to a room or four to a room. Most of the people were foreign nationals in the prison, about 64%. Most of those Hispanic. There were Asians, Germans, Russians, Canadians. The prison looked like a community college. Grass, trees, looked really nice if you just looked at it and forgot that it was a prison. But one of the problems was that there wasn't much education going on. So a woman could be there for 10, 15, 20 years and leave the prison without any way to support herself, without any skill under her belt, without a way to support herself and her children. Most of the women were there for drug charges. 11% of the women were there on immigration charges, and they were like my roommate. My roommate, Marina, had a 41-month sentence for re-entering the United States. She lived in the United States for over 25 years. She had 7 children. They were all born here. Her family's all in the United States, but she's not a citizen. She was deported, and she came back to be with her family. She said to me, "I don't think it was wrong to come home." You know, so she's in there for 41 months. When I first got to the prison, I went into the chaplain's office to say hello. And I saw a watercolor of the little Plowshares logo that I had made when I had been there before with the Isaiah quote, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares." And he had framed it, and it was up on the wall in his office. And I'm telling you that to sort of give you an idea of the support that I had in the prison from the chaplaincy office. They were very kind to me. The prison is sort of a microcosm of our society, and it's a small environment, and you can see things more clearly, at least I could, than sometimes you can see out here. And the Chomsky's term, manufactured consent, became very real to me inside the prison. When the hijackings happened, the women were glued to CNN from early morning till late at night. And that's where all their information came, right from CNN. And revenge and retaliation were just on everyone's mind. And that's all they could think of, you know. And I talked to the women. They were very interested in asking for my opinion. And I talked about forgiveness and how we're supposed to love our enemies and how we need to be nonviolent. And I carried in my pocket a list of all the countries that the United States had bombed since 1945. And I talked about Iraq and the sanctions and how many children have died each month because of the sanctions. And at first the women would listen a little bit, but after about one day of this, they couldn't listen at all. They'd ask for my opinion or something, and then they would interrupt me because they couldn't hear anything that disagreed with the idea of revenge. The bloodthirst was so thick. It felt in the prison like it feels right before a fight. You know, everyone's thinking of revenge and blood. You can just feel it, feel the tension. I felt pretty isolated, and I felt scared, too, because it felt like all the things that I believed in, forgiveness and cooperation and nonviolence, were just, there was no room for them anymore. And that made me very sad. My friend Marilyn had been put in the SHU, and I was trying to communicate with her by going out of bounds and having lookouts and trying to get to her to tell her what was happening and to get news to her support people. And I went to talk to the chaplain. And as it turned out, he was having a service for the staff, a memorial service for the staff. They were singing America the Beautiful. So I waited for the service to be over, and we talked. And the first thing he shared with me was that when they were planning the service, he was afraid that the warden would want to have an American flag in the sanctuary, in the chapel. And he said that he was prepared to say no because he felt that would be idolatry. But then the warden hadn't asked for it, and he was very relieved. So later that evening, we did have a service for the prisoners, and one of the Muslim sisters read from the Quran, and the chaplain asked me to read from the scriptures. I read the Beatitudes and the Love of Enemies section from Matthew, and then one of the Jewish women read one of the Psalms. And we sang Amazing Grace. The native women sang a song about freedom. And it was a good service. It was attended by almost everyone in the prison. During this time, I really relied heavily on my outside friends, on the Jonah House community, on the people in California, and on all of you who sent articles to me, because there was no way to get news, and I really needed encouragement. You know, I called home several times. I talked to Ardith one time about, you know, how do you build compassion? Ardith reminded me again that you speak as best you can, you act as best you can, and it's God who builds the compassion. That's not up to us. I had been active in a group called Toastmasters. Maybe some of you know about that group. It's an international group to teach speaking skills. And we had one in the prison, and I had given an icebreaker, which is your first talk, and I talked about plowshares. And then I gave a second talk, which was a convincing talk, and I talked about radiation and depleted uranium and the radiation in our environment and how it causes cancers. And after 9/11, when we had our next Toastmasters, the prison guard who sponsored it came up to me and said, well, you know, we're not going to have any talk about 9/11. There's not going to be any discussion. And it was right before the meeting, and I didn't have time to argue with her or even think about really what that meant. And so I convened the meeting. And during the meeting, one of my friends, Pearl, gave a little talk that someone from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship had brought in. Was a little discussion about forgiveness and how we need to respond with compassion. And right away, the guard stood up and said, oh, there's not going to be any evaluation of this. There's going to be no discussion. This is off limits. We can't talk about this. And And I said, but this, she's talking about nonviolence. How can nonviolence be censored? We need to talk about that. That's not terrorism. There's nothing wrong with talking about that. Anyway, we had a discussion, and the guard said, well, this is a voluntary group. You don't need to be in it if you don't want to abide by the rules. So the next day I went to the chaplain and talked to him about this situation. And the next week I see a notice up that says there's going to be a current events group that the chaplain is going to lead. So I thought, great. So before this group, I was able to make copies of about 7 different articles that people had sent me about what was happening in Afghanistan. And we had this current events group. We met every week. And it was very interesting because it became clear to me immediately that the women really didn't know much about U.S. foreign policy, about the history, and they really needed to learn. When I would talk about Iraq, I just met blank faces. People didn't know about the sanctions. People didn't know about what the U.S. foreign policy had been in other countries. So that group was very good, and it was very much a challenge because there were women there who were Zionists. There were women there who were knee-jerk patriots, and a lot of women who came just to learn. But I enjoyed that group very much. One of the women said, you know, the real problem is we're just concerned. She said, I'm concerned about me and my children. And she said, that's all of us here are just concerned about me and mine. And, you know, she said, you can talk about the children of Afghanistan, but really this is my concern. And what do you say to someone who's convinced that her and her children are the only things that she's going to worry about? You know, you need to be very gentle, and you need to say something that she can really hear. So I had a constant challenge in front of me. When the war started, when the United States actually started bombing, that weekend I lost my job that I had in the kitchen, and I got assigned to the carpentry shop, and the cups that I had been making, some peace cups, were smashed and thrown away. Now, I guess this might all be coincidence. I don't know. But it did happen. And so I was in the carpentry shop, and my boss was a very nice man. He was a redneck, conservative California tradesman. And he had this carpentry crew. They were very kind to me, and we talked each day we took about half an hour to talk about things, and I'd listen to the news, and I brought up what was going on in the war and what kind of bombs we were using. I talked about our Plowshares action because he asked why I was there in the prison, and it was interesting. You know, when I talked about the daisy cutter bombs, everyone thought that was just way, way too much, that wasn't necessary. You know, even my boss, who thought that we should defend ourselves, didn't think the daisy cutters were right. So that was always a help to be able to struggle with people and to talk. There was a fellow who worked in food service who was in the reserves and was expecting a phone call every day to get called up. And he talked to me quite often, and he said that he was afraid he was going to get called and would have to go fight in Afghanistan, and he'd get over there and he'd find out he was fighting on the wrong side. And fortunately, he never got called over there, at least while I was there. I was also very fortunate. There was a group of Buddhists who came in and had a Buddhist meditation class every week. And that was a time for me to meet with other women who were, at least would calm themselves down and interested in talking about nonviolence to some extent. And I was also on the Suicide Watch cadre, which gave me a chance to get to know other women and get to know the staff a little bit. Many of the staff started conversations with, I know the U.S. isn't coming into this with clean hands. You know, they at least acknowledged that there's certain problems with our foreign policy. While I was there, the chaplain gave me a copy of Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship. And I hadn't read that before, and it was very interesting for me to read. And Bonhoeffer had an idea that particularly hit me while I was there in the prison. He talked about single-minded obedience. Now, any of you who have been in a jail or a prison, I guess, or the military, you know about single-minded obedience. You know, when the lieutenant tells you to button your shirt or pick up a piece of paper or whatever, you'd better do it. And there's no time to procrastinate or talk about it or talk about the ethics, because if you do any of that, the cuffs are on immediately. So that's sort of single-minded obedience. And I think that Jesus is much more worthy of our obedience than a lieutenant in a prison, right? So if we could only follow Jesus with the same obedience. Now, Jesus tells us to love our enemies, to love each other as brothers and sisters. And then something like this, you know, the towers happen, and people are all of a sudden saying, well, is this really going to work, you know? Does God really mean that? Was it translated right? Or it's not very practical right now. So, anyway, I relied very much on community, on all of you for help, and I appreciate all your prayers and your letters. And that's all.
That was peace activist Susan Crane speaking in Washington, D.C. on December 28th, just after being released from prison. Our next speaker, Phil Berrigan, 77, has been active in the peace movement since the 1960s and has taken part in and been arrested for a number of plowshares actions dating back to the 1980s. Berrigan is a World War II veteran, an author, and the father of three. He's also a member of the Jonah House community.
Well, I just want to reiterate what Susan and Kenji have said about our debt to all of you. From time to time during this last stretch, I've had to reflect what having people in jail meant to a community at home. And it meant a vast expenditure of not only time, but money and effort and letters and all the elements of support. And some would realize that the folks at home have it a hell of a lot tougher than we did, wherever we were. I don't want to talk about jails this morning because I think the whole prison evolution here in the United States could have happened even earlier. I remember a very significant book done by Robert J. Lifton and Richard Falk called Indefensible Weapons. And in it, they just promoted an obvious thesis that if you're into nuclearism, you're into totalitarianism. And fascism is inevitable. Now, in that context, of course, prisons are inevitable. And maybe even our prison development here in this country is late coming. So it's a spin-off, huh? It's a byproduct. And it's inevitable, to repeat again. I'd like to share some very, very heavy stuff with you that I don't make on my own authority. And that would have to do largely with the studies of Dr. Rosalie Bertel from Toronto. She's a world-class epidemiologist. And she's one of the few scientists in the world who have had the competence and guts to release information like came out within the last year or 18 months. And she says, in effect, nuclear war has already happened. And we need to be aware of it. It hasn't happened in the way we imagined it would happen, but it's happened. And hundreds of millions of people have already died or have been diseased or maimed because it has happened. And then the seeds of further human destruction are all now implanted in the planet. And the death toll, by way of expectation, can be looked upon as mounting all the time. So she says, since 1945 and the first test at Alamogordo, New Mexico, the nuclear club has killed, maimed, or diseased 1.3 billion people. Now make sure you've heard me right and heard her right. She says 1.3 billion people, 1,300 million. So we as Americans, since we're in love with our country, since we would like to take it back from the bosses and warriors, we're interested in what our share of that kind of horrific action is. And conservatively, it's one half, perhaps 60%. We kicked it off and led it all the way. And the last study I've heard about the expenditure of that is by the Brookings Institute, which is a conservative think tank here in Washington, D.C. Last I read, $19 trillion on past, present, future wars. $19 trillion. That's how much us Americans treasure our violence because it secures our lifestyle. And we like living like we do. We are consuming from the planet 6 to 7 times our share right now. Energy, goods and services, what have you. And we're a drain upon the world. And in the eyes of many, including the Muslim world, we're a curse upon the world, this great society. So we're responsible for half, conservatively. That's 650 million people over a 56-year period, or 57 years with a new one coming up. Now, where does it come from? Well, United Nations studies have said that most of it comes from testing. Most of it comes from testing. And I was appalled in reading Bertel's latest book, where she speaks about the warmongers using the planet Earth as their latest weapon, using the resources and the facilities and the riches of the Earth as their latest weapon. That's her thesis. Anyway, included in testing would be the fact that we have exploded maybe up in the upper stratosphere or ionosphere, 8 nuclear devices, some of them hydrogen bombs. I knew nothing about this. What goes up comes down, and it comes down upon the Earth. In addition, we have had at least 3 space vehicles that we know about carrying heavy doses of plutonium, 17,000 curies apiece, that have crashed upon the Earth. And people are dying. Not only from cancer, but the radiation depresses the human immune system. It depresses it. It weakens it. It makes you a pushover for a whole galaxy of other diseases, including possibly HIV and AIDS. So most of it from testing. Where else? 4 nuclear wars now, done by the United States. Not only Japan, 1945, but also Iraq, Yugoslavia, and now Afghanistan with depleted uranium, which the spin doctors from the Pentagon would say is not a nuclear weapon at all. Maybe the most noxious and the most insidious of the whole nuclear weapons school, depleted uranium. God knows how many people in Iraq have already died. In Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Serbia, more, and now in Afghanistan. So, four nuclear wars, file that away. This is horrifically bad news, and I realize that. And some Americans would go into shock at hearing it, would go into a further species of denial, would hide out under the woodwork, but not people like you. Not people like you. Okay, well, the next element. We've got 103 nuclear power plants here in this country. And study after study after study have indicated that the incidence of cancer and other related disease is astronomically higher within a close radius of these plants. They shut one down in California called Rancho Seco. And they found that infanticide and birth deformities eased off radically as soon as the damn plant was shut down. So we've got 104 of them on the line, 103, 104 at the present time. And they're all Three Mile Island, you know, Fermi outside of Detroit, on and on and on. They're all polluting air, soil, and water. A Japanese team came over after Three Mile Island, and they discovered trees in four seasons. One tree in four seasons because of what happened at Three Mile Island. And now our peerless leaders, Cheney and the rest of them, are advocating a new species of nuclear plant that doesn't even contain a containment vessel. And those who are up on the whole counter-terrorist thing say, well, you can you can use a light plane if you want to load another explosive and fly it right into one of these hideous installations. And then millions would die. To continue, we've got about 149 nuclear weapon stations where the weapons, one component or the other, has been turned out. See, the Department of Energy, with no shame at all, announces that 109 of them can't be cleaned up. Can't be cleaned up. Paducah in Kentucky, you know, Fernald outside of Cincinnati, Hanford, Washington, can't be cleaned up. Too expensive. We don't have money something like this. What's more, perhaps couldn't never be successfully cleaned up. You can't put that fissionable material back into the ground. Once you take it out, you've had it, and human beings are going to suffer. And the whole vegetative and animal world is going to suffer because you've had the arrogance and the temerity to take it out of the ground. So you make what they call national sacrifice zones out of these places. You put a fence around them, or you go ahead and mothball them with concrete. Anyway, you keep the public out, vast acreage, beautiful ecology before this social pollution came in. And so it goes on. And we've got about maybe 8 million tons of exposed uranium tailings, see, around the planet, in South Africa, in Western Canada, Southwest United States, Australia, Belgian Congo, see, wherever this deadly junk has been mined. Now Australia. Kieran O'Reilly and Trina Lenthal did an action against the new uranium mines in Australia. So, what happens with all these exposed tailings? Well, the rainfall leaches it into the water system. The wind picks up radioactivity from the tailings itself and just circulates it. And people die as a result. You can see the potential. So be convinced of this, that nuclear war has already happened, that the American share of this is about 650 million people since 1945. That amounts to a Holocaust every year since 1945, a Holocaust of 12 or 13 million, comparable to the one suffered by Jewish people and by dissidents under the Nazis. And that's happened, and it's now implanted, see? And that people like ourselves are the only resource against this kind of social psychosis. It's madness. It's possession. I was much taken with the 8th chapter of John's Gospel, where our Lord gets into heavy controversy with what is called the Judeans, the temple state crowd. And he asks them a simple question. He says, "What are you trying to kill me for?" And they say, "Well, who's trying to kill you? See? You're nothing but, I mean, you got the mentality of a Samaritan," another hated people. And he says, "Well, you're trying to kill me because of your father. And your father's not Abraham. Your father is Satan." And then he begins to do something that I've never found in any of world literature. And you can take that for what it's worth, because all of us ought to have our nose stuck in that Bible on a daily basis. It's written for our instruction. He links lying and murder. And he links them both with demonism. And he says, if you're into killing people, you're possessed. You're into demonism. You're into devil worship. I've seen where the demons are demythologized. They're stripped of their covering. You want to kill another person? Okay, you're opening yourself up for demonic possession. Because we're sisters and brothers of one another, and God knows he or she did not intend us to be killing one another. So I'll just end it on there. A few footnotes on the war, on this nasty little rhubarb going on in Afghanistan. It's been 5 years in preparation since 1970, 1996, 1997. 5 years in preparation. It came out of a failed series of talks with the Taliban, some of them down in Texas, in Houston, where our peerless leaders tried to negotiate safety for pipelines across Afghanistan going east towards the Indian Ocean and west towards Kosovo in Yugoslavia. And the talks failed, and the Taliban was not given in. They're not given in. So the war began to be planned right now, because right now world oil production is pretty much at a peak, and as they say, it's going to decline, and they've got to find new sources. And Afghanistan and those four oil-rich republics around the Caspian Basin, they're the next resource, and that's why we're at war. There were 60,000 troops on maneuvers right around September 11th in the Middle East and also in South Asia. They were NATO troops, they were British, and they were American. And they were poised to move into Afghanistan by mid-October. The BBC disclosed in mid-July that Pakistani high officials and Americans were predicting that hostilities in Afghanistan would open in mid-October. Nothing to do with September 11th. Nothing, absolutely nothing to do with September 11th. Secretary of State Powell has admitted that they don't even have circumstantial evidence against bin Laden. That he probably didn't even know that this was coming down. And I don't have any sympathy from Bin Laden. He's a CIA clone, see? And, well, enough said. Huh? I don't have any sympathy for him. See? But I don't think the guy had anything to do with September 11th. It was probably funded by Saudi Arabians themselves, who were pissed off because we were insisting on keeping troops in Saudi Arabia with Medina and Mecca there, the holy places, the Muslim holy places. So this war is a gigantic scam, and we need to scream this from the housetops. It's a gigantic swindle and scam. It's the biggest lie in our recent history, and we Americans are very, very good at lying. Very good. We've murdered so many people. There's got to be a correlation. We're good at lying. You know? But people like you should not lie. You know? And we need to inform our friends about this deadly nonsense. Notice how I use the word nonsense. It's nonsensicalness. I'll let it go at that, you know. From the housetops, we ought to burst the bubble. Thanks so much.
Some of us, Phil, don't know the whole story about what came down, you know, on September 11th when you were in the joint. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've been sharing a bit of this with some of you. Right in the next cubicle was a little Chinese guy. And his sister worked at the World Trade Center. So he was in a big sweat when the first plane struck the World Trade Center as to whether she was alive or dead. He discovered later on that she was driving in from New Jersey, where she lived, and that things were all clogged up in the tunnels. So she came in by way of Lincoln Tunnel, I think, or Holland Tunnel, and was not able to get through, turned back, in fact, and she went back home. So he was much relieved by that. Anyway, he comes up to me, and he says, "All hell is breaking loose," he says. "A plane just went into the World Trade Center." So I march into, right adjacent to my cubicle, was a large boob tube room. And they had four tubes in there. Two Spanish-speaking stations, because the majority of the prisoners I was with were Latinos, and two English-speaking. So I march in there, and by that time, the second plane had struck, and the towers began to, from the jet fuel, of course, the tremendous heat generated, the towers began to collapse. And I was watching them appalled. See? And then a cop comes in the boob tube room and he says, "Come on, we got to go over to the lieutenant's office." So I said, "Well, what's up? What's up?" I suspected what was up. Knowing them with a little experience. So I go with them. You know, and they got the handcuffs and shackles waiting for me over the lieutenant's office. No IS, no kiss my ass, anything from them. I said, "What's up?" And they said, one of them grunted, "Security. Security." I said, "I'm here." And that happened in New York City. What do you mean, security? But anyway, they marched me up to solitary. And Liz, after not having heard from me because I was completely incommunicado in solitary, no phone calls, no visitors, and wouldn't give me any stamps. I couldn't buy them in the canteen. I couldn't write out. You just have to kind of gulp and go on faith. But Liz smelled a rat, and she started calling the prison and then some of our friends, and they came forward and began to call the prison, and they got very, very antsy there. because they can't stand public scrutiny. And after 12 days, they call me down, big meeting with the warden and all of that nonsense, and disclosed with great joy that they were going to release me back into population. They're all grinning at me, you know. They're all showing the teeth. They're all showing the teeth. Happy day. Let's enjoy it together. Yep. So, that's... And several guys. There was one Lebanese guy. There was a Palestinian. There was a Jamaican. 13 of us were locked up. None of them had constituencies. None of them had families here in this country. Nobody to intercede for them. They didn't get a one word of explanation as to why they were locked up. Not one word. I didn't.
Were they released, the other guys?
No, after me. Always after. No, they did 15, 16 days. And I must confess to you, you know, that this, if you don't know how to handle silence, it's going to be tough. Because very often you can't get a Bible and you can't get any reading, you know. And the silence is just oppressive. And you do get caught up on sleep enough. But the cells are lovely and clean. It's a new facility. You got a shower there. You've got a sink, a toilet, what have you. You know, it's spanking clean. See? But the tedium gets you. And a lot of these guys locked up with me don't have any tradition of handling silence. They don't pray. They don't read, you know. They don't talk with one another that well. So... It was very hard on them. Very hard on them. A certain amount of unfairness towards people like yourself, like throwing this horrific data at you, see, with no daylight as to what we do. What we do. I mean, if the bosses and warriors are killing us for whatever reason, and they are, if nuclear war has happened in a way unimaginable to us, what do we do? What do we do? And so a very, very precious book, some friend sent into prison, and I read it, and it's called what, Liz? No Greater Force? A Force More Powerful. Right, thank you. And a study of nonviolent resistance in the 20th century. So I scoped out the Russian Revolution of 1905 that provided a kind of remote background for the revolution at the end of World War I. And then Gandhi's work in India, and then the work of Solidarity in Poland. And all of them involved non-cooperation. All of them involved a general strike where you build over a period of months and years, and then you call a date and you say, let's bring the most vulnerable aspect of this rotten society, let's bring it down or halt it or check it or hamper it by a strike. And you start out on a gradated level. You start out with non-cooperation. You cut the buying of non-essentials. See, you don't fly. You don't drive when you don't need to. Yeah. You cut down on the goodies. Yeah. Because the only soft underbelly that they have is the economy. It's the economy. This is what they watch. And this is what they panic over. So you go to students, you go to church people, you go to blue collars, you go to other elements of the society where you might get a hearing, see? And you work over a period of months and years and so on. And you build towards a general strike. So that's the only thing that I thought made sense in light of what we saw at the Pentagon this morning. Anybody want to discuss that? See, it's part of my faith that the people are out there, that there are tens of millions of good people here in this country who are appalled by the goings-on. We have fought one foreign war a year since 1945, intervening constantly in the societies of other people and killing on a massive scale, one per year, you know. And all of this does not go unrecognized, you know. People have been betrayed, you see, by the fourth arm of government, which is the media, have been betrayed by them and betrayed by the major institutions, including the church and synagogue, you know. But nonetheless, truth seeps through cracks. And there's a lot of awareness here in this country that things are out of control, that this society is a massive madhouse. It's an asylum. Yeah. So the people are out there, and I think they're approachable, and with a good deal of dedication and work, you know, they can offer some nonviolent, decent, human alternatives. You isolate a couple of good people per state. I was thinking, you know, if my community approves of this, I was thinking of heading for New England, right up to Maine, where we have a lot of friends, see? And leave one or two or three or four good people per state. And outline them and place material at their disposal and keep in contact with them by email and by mail and by telephone. Okay? And run with it and do what you can. Do what you can. Make it a modest grassroots effort coming from the people. That's very important. The gospel says you got to come from the margins for any social change. You gotta come from the desert. You know? Okay.
One thing that occurs to me, as you ask, is that we need community. We need to live the way we want a future society to be. We need to live that now. So we need to live with mutual relationships and without exchange, like using a common purse, and trying to prefigure how we want society to be in our lives today.
Found to be lousy with potential. This idea of general strike, that it's perhaps the only ultimate weapon that people have against the bosses and warriors. You know? But it allows action on the part of everyone. Gandhi used to make a great point of this. He'd say, well, even the infirm, even the wheelchair-bound can lead the movement towards liberation. And he realized something that the gospel emphasizes all the time, that it's the spirit that's important. It's the spirit of a person that's important. You know? Not the flesh, but the spirit. Well, it seems to me that there are tens of millions of Americans around who would be appalled at the extent of governmental killing. 650 million people over a period of 56 years. And secondly, they would be appalled at the fact that they're targeted, just like all of us are targeted. Yeah. We don't have any guarantee that we're not going to get sick. And some of us here in this circle are going to die of cancer or related serious disease. And the bosses and warriors are mainly, with our cooperation, responsible for this. It seems to me, you know, Bertel in her first book illustrated the experience of the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. where the Nazis convinced them that, look, we got no problem with you people, and we're going to resettle all of you on land in Western Russia that we've already cleared. Farmland. It's going to be yours. We gave them their own police force, fire brigades, allowed small businesses, and kept a stranglehold on only two things. One would be food, so that they were enervated and weakened all the time, and the other one would be communications with the outside world. Bertel says we're all in that state now. We're cooperating in our own demise, our own destruction. We're all in that state now. Yeah. And I believe that's an accurate historical analogy. You know, it was broken only when some intrepid young Jew broke out of the ghetto and started following the railroad tracks as they went eastern into Poland, you know, and to Auschwitz and Treblinka and places like that. And he came back and he told what he had found, and his people in the ghetto says, "No, you got to be kidding. You got to be kidding. They're not going to do that to us." But they were. There's this slow assimilation of reality, huh? Where you've been living in a kind of psychological Disneyland for decades now. Decades. See? And you're into denial without even realizing it. And suddenly the bubble bursts. And that's going to be painful, and it's going to be maybe even protracted. But it's got to be burst. And we're the only people around to do it. Who else is there? The institutions have all failed us. The institutions have all failed us. Every major institution here in this country default in its vocation towards the people. We only got one another, and we got God Almighty. And we have the example of our Lord. And that's what we have. And that's more than enough. If we say yes to it. Yes. Yeah. As Ellsberg told me 10 years ago, after the Pentagon Papers, he says, if we're lucky, we'll be doing this for the rest of our lives. If we're lucky. If we're not blown, the kingdom come. And that's eminently sensible, what he said. Remember that, Liz? Thank you.
Peace activist Phil Berrigan speaking on the eve of the new year in Washington, D.C. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton.